2 Timothy chapter 3, we'll read the first five verses of that. It starts in verse 1. But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, have nothing to do with them.
We are fond of superlatives. We like to talk about the best of this and the best of that. And if you look online, you can always find the 10 best movies, 10 best books, or the 10 best anything along those lines. Even in Bible study, we are interested in the superlatives. We like to talk about and quiz our young people on who was the wisest man in the Bible, Solomon, who was the strongest man in the Bible, Samson, who was the oldest man in the Bible, Methuselah, who was the shortest man in the Bible, which some people say was Zacchaeus, but others with great fervor will affirm Bildad the Shuhite was the shortest man in the Bible. Even sometimes we talk about the superlatives in the negative direction. The worst of this and the worst of that and the worst of the other. And this morning, I want us to turn our attention in that direction in our Bible study and to think about the one of the worst men in the Bible. In fact, I want us to think specifically about the stupidest man in the Bible. And I know when I say that word that I shouldn't be calling people stupid. My mother pounded that or tried to pound that into my brothers and me. And that was one of the things that you were sure to get a switch for if she heard you say stupid to one of your brothers. But of course, she wasn't always present, so we did, in fact, use that word on occasion. Of course, the Bible itself warns us against making that kind of judgment, that kind of condemnation of our brothers. Matthew chapter 5, verse 22, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says in Matthew 5, verse 22, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into fiery hell. So we ought to be really careful about saying someone is a fool or saying that someone is stupid. But sometimes it's just the truth, and it's just what they are. And sometimes perhaps we ought to point out the failings of others, not so much as an effort to condemn them, as an effort to become an object lesson for us and maybe for others. And so with that kind of an attitude in mind, I want to point out to you this morning and offer for your consideration Nabal, the stupidest man in the Bible. Now, that's not just my judgment. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, we meet Nabal. In fact, that's the only chapter in the Bible that tells us anything about Nabal, but practically the entire chapter is devoted to understanding Nabal. In fact, really, in some ways, the first verse of chapter 25 is about the death of Samuel, one of the no doubt best men in the Bible, and the mourning that accompanied his death. And then at the very end of the chapter, we have the death of Nabal, and really kind of the celebration that accompanies his death. The Bible opens the story of Nabal in 1 Samuel 25, verse 2. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. And he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. And just to break into the story, now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. And we may wonder about, the contrast between Abigail and Nabal, and I think the writer here is like astonished by that as well. Here is one of the best examples of womanhood in the scriptures, Abigail, who is intelligent and beautiful. And here is her husband, Nabal, who is a fool. just as his name identifies him as being a fool, and who is churlish in some of the translations, who is evil in his dealings with other people. He is a fool, the Bible says, just as his name suggests that he's a fool, because Nabal means a fool. And you wonder why parents would ever give their child a name like that. I'm not sure that they were possessed by any kind of prophetic insight and knew to name him that. Maybe, and this is just speculation perhaps, maybe it is the fact that they had named him something that sounds similar to Nabal. In fact, there are, I am told, a few Hebrew words that mean positive things, like a flame, that could have been a likely name for Hebrew baby, but they sound very much like Nabal, which means a fool, and that perhaps by his own life, by his own foolishness, his name had been transmuted into this Nabal, which is the fool. But, of course, it is clear that his character and his name coincide at this point. Maybe it was just a nickname for him, or maybe, in fact, the word Nabal was kind of a name that people had forgotten what it means, because how many of you know what your name means today? Sometimes we start looking at that when we are looking at baby names, and then we're surprised at what the names might mean. My name, of course, Thaxter, means thatcher of roofs. So fortunately, I am not kind of matched up with my name. But maybe that's the way it was. And then as his character develops and unfolds, it was clear that this Nabal original meaning was appropriate to him. Nonetheless, the Bible tells us that Nabal is a fool, that he is mean-spirited, and that he is ungenerous and evil in his dealings with other people. And so this story opens at the sheep-sharing time. And he's a rich man, and he is sharing his sheep in Carmel there. He has a home in Maon. He has his sheep in a sheep-sharing house in Carmel. He is a rich man. And it is the spring of the year, and it has been a prosperous year. After the winter, spring is naturally a joyous time, but especially for those who are rich, especially for those who have sheep, who are going to share the sheep. The wool is at its best in the spring of the year after a heavy winter's growth. And, of course, the sheep don't particularly need the wool during the summertime. So now is the time to shear and to take the wool and to take it to market and to prosper. Sheep sharing is, like the harvest time, a time of great joy and great feasting and hospitality. For God has blessed the man who has sheep to shear, and so it is time to be thankful and to be generous. And Nabal, of course, has much to be thankful for. He is rich. We're told that he has 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. The Bible tells us that Abraham was rich and only tells us that he had many sheep. When we read about Job, who was one of the rich men of the Old Testament, he had 7,000 sheep, and then when God blesses him again, he has 14,000 sheep. So Nabal may not be in the 1%, but he's clearly in the 10%. He is richer than most of the people around about him. He is rich enough that he is the envy of many of his neighbors. He is rich in earthly possessions. But maybe the thing that he ought to be most thankful about is not his sheep and his goats and his wool and his riches, but he has a wife who is discerning and beautiful. And what greater blessing can a man have than that? Proverbs 31 in verse 10, that proverb about the worthy woman that we think about so much. Proverbs 31 in verse 10 says, "An excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels." If she's worth more than jewels, she is certainly worth more than sheep. But here's a man who has sheep and a wife who is beautiful and discerning. Maybe you have to make that choice sometimes. You want a wife with understanding, or you want a wife who's beautiful and foolish. Which do you want? But Nabal doesn't have to make that choice. He has a wife who is beautiful and discerning. And that's a great gift from God. Proverbs 19 and verse 14 reminds us that house and wealth are an inheritance from the fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And Nabal has this to be grateful for. And speaking of house and wife, he is from an honored family. He is a Calebite. And you remember Caleb, one of only two men who left Egypt and were faithful enough to enter into the promised land. Caleb and Joshua, who among the spies alone were willing to tell the truth and who trusted in God. So he has much to be thankful for. And you think about the sources of his prosperity too. His ancestors, no doubt, have contributed to his wealth. Unlike today, many people in those days inherited what they had from their ancestors. And clearly, when they'd gone into the promised land and Caleb had gotten his inheritance, a relatively prosperous portion, that it had been passed on through the generations. Now Nabal has inherited some of that. And think about the character of Caleb. He was an industrious man. When it came time for him to get his inheritance from Joshua, he didn't ask for some easy, comfortable place. He said, "Give me this hill and I'll go take it." And that's the kind of ancestors that Nabal has. And he comes from a family, I think, probably of industrious people who have passed on to him some prosperity. And he should be grateful, of course, for that. In the Republic, Plato writes about Socrates discussing with an older man and ask him about the blessings of his life. And he says, "I am halfway between my father and my grandfather. My grandfather increased the wealth of the family threefold and passed it on to my father. My father reduced it by half by his wastrel ways, and I am halfway in between that and satisfied that I can pass on more to my children than I received." And Nabal is in this kind of a family. They pass things on to him, and he has kind of an obligation to be industrious. And I don't say that he's not industrious, but he certainly has an obligation to be grateful to the family that has come before. And of course, some of his prosperity is not just due to his ancestors. Some of his prosperity is due to David's protection. David has been there in the wilderness with them all winter long, with 600 outlaws who are fleeing from the vengeance of Saul. And outlaws, 600 of them in the wilderness, are going to need a lot of food. They're going to need a lot of the material things of life. And where do they get those? They wrested out of the wilderness. But it would be so easy, so tempting to take a sheep here, a sheep there, a goat or two for their own. But they have not done that. In 1 Samuel chapter 25 and verses 14 through 15, we should look at what David has to say himself. David, at sheep shearing time, he sends his young men to Nabal and he gives them this message. 1 Samuel 25, verse 6, "Have a long life, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we've not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David." And that report from David about the way he had and he, his men had treated Nabal and his men is reaffirmed in verses 14 and 15 when one of the servants reports this conversation to Abigail. And in 1 Samuel 25 and verse 14, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, and all the time we were with them tending the sheep." So we think about the prosperity of Nabal. To some ways, David has contributed to that. They would have lost some sheep in the wilderness if not to the wolves and to the other predators, certainly to the human predators who roamed into the wilderness. There were other bands of outlaws who had less conscientiousness than David and less concern for the property of others. And these shepherds all this winter have been moving their flocks around, and they have noted the protection that David has provided for them, a wall, he says, for them, protecting them against the predators of all kinds. And not a single one of their sheep have they taken. Not a single time have David and his men requested or taken anything out of the flocks of Nabal. And surely at sheep shearing time, when they start counting, you say, wow, this was a really great winter. We did not miss any sheep other than to a few that have fallen into the ravines or fallen to a disease. It's an amazingly prosperous time for us. But there was no gratitude in Nabal about that. Some of his prosperity, of course, too, should be due to the understanding of his wife. For as Proverbs 31 and verse 11 says, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain, and she does him good and not evil all the days of his life. Who can count up all the prosperity that has come to Nabal because of the discernment of his wife, that she has been frugal in taking care of the household, that she has advised him and has advised his servants, apparently, about how to manage things? It is interesting that when he has this encounter with David and has made a really bad decision to scorn David's request, that in fact the servants have enough confidence to come to her and to lay the story out before her, apparently with an expectation that she is once again going to rescue Nabal from his own foolishness. His prosperity then is not his own. It is not as if he's done it all with his own hands. And most of all, his prosperity is from the hand of God. For every good thing, every good and perfect gift, James says in James 1 and verse 17, is from above, coming from the Father of lights. And Nabal, the fool that he is, does not appreciate any of those things. He is like the rich man in the parable in Luke, who says, you know, I'm going to tear down these barns and build bigger ones because I have increased my property. And despite all of his wealth and his prosperity and the nice life that he lives, he is a mean man. As per verse 3, he is harsh and evil, churlish in some translations, badly behaved in some translations. No doubt. This is an indication of how he treated his servants and his family and his friends, assuming he even temporarily had any friends, because a man like this is not going to have friends for very long. Certainly, the evidence from this story is that he speaks vilely about others because of the way he spoke about David. You hear what he says when he receives David's message, 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 9. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name, and then they waited. They made a request, and it was as respectful as it possibly could be. And then Nabal answered David's servants, and he said, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered from my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" So they took that message back to David with, you might recognize, an expected kind of response. That's the way he talked to everybody, I think. You hear how scornful he is about that. Who is David? Of course, he knows who David is because he goes ahead and said, "Who's the son of Jesse?" He knows who David is. He knows the story about David and about Saul. Everybody knows the story of David and Saul. And some of them may have taken one side and some may have taken the other, but they know who David is. Bathsheba, when she hears about this, she knows not only who David is, she knows which side of this confrontation between David and Saul is right. She knows which side God is on. Nabal could have known those things as well. But no, he is a mean-spirited and a harsh man, and that's the way he treats everybody. Verse 17 and verse 25, he's called a worthless fellow. And in verse 25, we're told that folly is with him. And in verse 36, we find out the way he spends his prosperity. He feasts until he is drunk and full of wine. Even his wife and his servants know what kind of a man he is, and they freely acknowledge it to one another. It's not like, should I say something ugly about the master to the wife? Should the wife say something ugly about him? They all know. Everybody knows. That's why his name is Nabal, and that's why they call him Nabal. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 17, the servant says to Abigail, "Now therefore know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak for him." What a kind of a man is this that his servants say this about him? They know what kind of a guy he is. And then in 1 Samuel 25, verse 25, Abigail goes and pleads on behalf, because you know what David did. When David got word from the young men about what Nabal had said, verse 13, David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went up behind David while 200 stayed with the baggage. 400 men with their swords, and David pretty much outraged by this insult that's come against him. And he is about to unleash the full force of these 400 outlaws on Nabal and his shepherds and his shearers and his servants. Most of all, of course, on Nabal. And they know. I mean, it's like anybody who heard what had happened, and this servant's like, oh no, this is about to all come tumbling down. And he goes to Abigail and says, "What can you do about this? Because nobody can talk to Nabal about it." And Abigail, she immediately packs up as much supplies as she can gather together in the moment of the time, and she goes to meet David. And in 1 Samuel 25, verse 25, she says to David, "Let not my lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." You recognize the kind of guy that he is. He is, in Shepherd's word, a devil at home. I don't know if he's the angel in the temple, but he is a devil at home, and everybody knows the kind of man that he is. He's the worst kind of man. He is unkind to his own. He is unkind to those who are under his protection and to those who are less fortunate than he is. Here it is, a festive day. A day in which prosperity has come to his house and in which he is required by the law to be generous. They're not the specific regulations about the shearing of sheep that there were about the harvest when the people of Israel were supposed to leave the corners of the field for the poor to come and to glean in. But there were specific rules that you were to share on the festive days with those in your community who were poor. And this man Nabal has no interest in that whatsoever. If nothing else, even if David and his men had not provided protection, he should have, by the law, if he is a true Israelite, have provided them with some of his prosperity. But no, he is not willing to do that. And it's clear that his servants know, you don't talk to Nabal, you don't reason with him, you don't offer him advice because of the kind of man that he is. Despite his wealth and despite his status, he is ungrateful. He doesn't appreciate what he has. He doesn't appreciate a godly wife. Abigail was the kind of wife that a man should desire, a kind of man that a wife should praise, the kind of wife that a man should cherish. And Nabal doesn't recognize anything about the kind of wife that he has, apparently. He's like, are you kidding me? Beauty and the Beast. It is like the typical kind of story. And yet this beauty is not going to transform this beast because he is a fool and completely unappreciative of the kind of wife that he has. And more than that, he doesn't recognize his obligation to God and his dependence upon God. He doesn't recognize that everything he has is from God. And as a result of his meanness and his ingratitude, he is certainly a fool. Refusing David's reasonable request in most foolish and ungenerous terms. He's the kind of man who doesn't even appreciate fairness. David and his men had protected his sheep and his shepherds and asked him only to provide what he thought was right on a festive day, only at a time of celebration and only at a time of counting his wealth. But he doesn't appreciate the fairness of that kind of request. Nor does he appreciate the laws of charity, that at this time he's supposed to be generous. But he's not a generous man. He is a selfish, self-centered, foolish man. He doesn't recognize what everybody else seems to recognize, what Abigail recognizes, that in fact, that God's hand is with David, and that he is the one who is going to inherit the throne rather than Saul's sons. He is not able to see the hand of God in his own life. So why would we expect him to see the hand of God in someone else's life? Abigail knows the story. Of course, she's discerning. But Nabal is a fool. He just has no understanding. And he doesn't even understand the danger that he's placed himself in. Here is a man with 600 armed outlaws surrounding him. And I don't care how much wealth he has, he doesn't have the force to meet that kind of force. And yet he insults him. Maybe because he really does know the kind of man that David is. Maybe because he really does know that David is a righteous man and is unlikely to choose this moment to take his own vengeance. Because you understand what's about to happen here. David is about to kill the Israelites. David is about to ruin what God is setting up for him to become the king of Israel. He is ruining this opportunity to be the righteous king who will pull all of these people together that Saul has scattered about. It was the Judah that came first of all and anointed him king in Hebron. And a big part of that's the Calebites. This is likely to be pretty disruptive. But Nabal doesn't understand all that. And he doesn't even understand that he is about to die. So he goes and feasts and gets drunk. His unreasoning behavior is just stupid. That's all there is to it. Instead of responding in gratitude, he answers David with harsh words. He calls David's integrity into question. He calls David a rebel. He likens David to just a servant who has run away from his master. The bloated ego of this man is pretty obvious, too, when you read verse 11. He uses the personal pronoun I or me 7 times in that verse. It's all about me. Big I, little you, me, 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 me. He's like a 3-year-old. My, 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 my. He is stupid as he lashes out at David's courteous messengers. They have offered him logic. They have thrown themselves on his mercy and on his charity. And he snaps and he snarls and says, "Who is he?" Implying that David is the worthless man, when his servants know, as they're listening to this, who the worthless man really is. His response is less a reasoned kind of answer than an outburst which is out of proportion to the event. And that's the way it is with fools. They get a little bit upset, and then what they say just goes on and on and on, and is out of all proportion to what really the event was. Isaiah 32 and verse 6 speaks about this kind of a man and this kind of a fool. Isaiah 32 and verse 6, "For the fool speaks folly, and his heart is busy with iniquity, to practice ungodliness, to utter error concerning the Lord, and to leave the craving of the hungry unsatisfied, and to deprive the thirsty of drink." Even if he is not a generous man, even if he were not such a mean-spirited man. Even if he is not a kind of a holy man at all, he should have at least been a little wiser. But he is just stupid. A gentle answer might have turned away a harsh response, as Proverbs 15 and verse 1 suggests. But no, instead he inflames the situation with the kind of a response that he gives. He is just stupid. He is so oblivious that while Abigail is interceding with David on his behalf, he is wallowing in pleasure. He is drinking and feasting. She is preventing a slaughter. He is slowly killing himself, getting drunk like a fool, unaware of the jeopardy that is brought on by his own stupidity. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 36 describes it pretty simply. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing the kind of self-destruction that a person like this brings on themselves. In fact, in Proverbs chapter 30, verse 21, one of those number sermons, there are three things, yea, four things. Proverbs 30 and verse 21 talks about this kind of a man. Proverbs 30 and verse 21, under three things the earth trembles. Under four it cannot bear up. A slave when he becomes king. A fool when he's filled with food. An unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she displaces her mistress. There are three, four things, really, that are just hard to take. And one of them is a fool when he's filled. And that is Nabal. He is unredeemable. That's a harsh thing to say, but unredeemable is the only word for him. He is drunk, and Abigail says, no point in talking to him now. Wait till tomorrow. And here's what we just find tomorrow, 1 Samuel 25 and verse 37. But in the morning, listen to this, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Here the Bible describes this when he sobers up the next morning, when the wine went out of him. It's not like on some occasions, the Bible says, the man recovered, or he came to his senses, or he came to himself. No, nothing so positive occurs to Nabal. The wine just kind of goes out of him. He's not even really a man. He is just a vessel for holding wine. He's just a bladder, and it's now empty. There's nothing of any value to him. And when his wife comes and tells him what has almost happened and what she's done, it is not like he understands the danger and the wisdom of Abigail and her worth. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't even consider an apology, much less any kind of restitution. You know, what does it mean that his heart died within him and became a stone? Some people say fear, but the episode is already passed. Abigail has already turned David aside. More likely what it is anger and resentment that Abigail has interfered. Anger and resentment that he owes again something to Abigail's prudence that he wasn't able to do himself. He is irredeemable. If he'd kissed Abigail and blessed her wisdom and generosity for intervening on his behalf, I think God would have spared him. And if God had spared him, it would have been a step toward becoming a better man. It would have been a step toward melting this hard heart that was already in him. It would have been a step toward becoming worthy of the blessings that God had showered on him, on the wife that was his. But he will not admit that he's wrong. He will not admit the indebtedness, and his heart becomes a stone, and he dies of it. Perhaps it was a natural death of wine, or maybe it was something that God just gave him 10 more days and that was it. But maybe it was just the ingratitude and the resentment and the meanness that just killed him. Because he's not really living life as a human being anyway. He is just irredeemably stupid. And what's the lesson for us? Not so much to judge Nabal, but is to say, let's be careful that we are not on the path to that kind of an end, that we're not on the path to becoming that kind of a man. In the Bible, a fool is someone who doesn't believe in God. Psalm 14 and verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. But really, as you read about the fool more and more, you find out it's not just some atheist. It's not just some simpleton who can't understand the evidences about the existence of God. It's not some agnostic who is just trying to wonder. The fool in the Bible is really not just the one who denies God, but the one who says no to God, who says there is no God because I don't want there to be a God. It is the kind of man who will not let an appeal be made to his better nature because he's choked off his better nature. He will not see the blessings that he has. He will not see the blessings that God has provided for him. It really is, in many ways, that he is ungrateful. The worst kind of stupidity. Nabal doesn't acknowledge the great kindness of Abigail in having put up with him for however many years it has been. He doesn't acknowledge the kindness that David has shown to him. He doesn't even acknowledge the blessings that come from God, that he has been blessed by God with a godly, a wise, and a beautiful wife, that he's been blessed by God with riches and safety, and that he's been blessed by God with David and his men who have protected him and his sheep and his shepherds all winter long. He's unwilling to acknowledge any of these blessings. His ingratitude has darkened his mind. That's what Paul says in Romans 1 and verse 21 when he describes the despicable conditions of the pagans in the first century. In Romans 1 and verse 21, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. Darkened, first of all, by ingratitude. Greg read 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. And you read about the terrible days that are coming. And I don't know whether we're living in these last difficult days or not, but I am certain that what he describes there is true of Nabal and is true of a lot of people in America today. Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, right in the middle of it. I think maybe that's one of those kind of chiastic structures in which the real point's right in the middle and everything else kind of falls around it. Unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Holding to a form of godliness, although they've denied its power. Avoid such men as these. But more than that, let us pray to God that he keeps us from becoming that kind of a person. When you think about the issue of gratitude for the things that we have, not a one of us here this morning that cannot count up blessings that amount to more than 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats that Nabal had. We have been blessed bountifully to live in this day and age, to live in this place. We've been blessed not just by circumstances, but by the hand of God deliberately. But think about this. And Donald chose the songs this morning to remind us of the love of Jesus Christ. How much has he given for us and sacrificed for us? Beyond any wealth or position in life, God has blessed us in Jesus Christ with great and precious promises of forgiveness and redemption and a kingdom of heaven. And we're even blessed, as Peter says, to partake of the divine nature. Let none of us be so ungrateful as to say no to the invitation that Jesus extends to us to come, to let him come in, to bless us with all of these wonderful things. Let us not be so ungrateful that we become stupid and darkened in our hearts, as did the pagans in the first century, as was Nabal. Let us listen as the voice of Jesus calls. And if you're subject to his invitation this morning, we'll encourage you, and as we encourage ourselves, to respond to that invitation.